say things are getting weird out there would be to make the understatement of the year. As we speak, people around the world are rioting for food to keep their families alive, and in some cases, killing each other to get at that food. And so today we ask, why can't the hungry of the world feed themselves? And furthermore, if you and I become hungry, how will we feed ourselves?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 589th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Manila who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones. Hello, Carol.
Hello, everyone.
And Carol and Parmley Taff is out on assignment today. Folks, things are getting weird out there. How weird? 37 nations in the developing world are in urgent need of food. How urgent? Upwards of 100 million people, of their citizens, 100 million citizens of those countries are facing severe hunger. In Cairo, there have been multiple incidents of people murdering each other to get at the food. And so today we ask, why can't the hungry of the world feed themselves? And furthermore, if something happens to our 2,000-mile-long food chain, how will we feed ourselves? Here to help us explore the question, we have Ray Cheska, who is the president of the World Ag Forum. Ray, welcome to the food chain.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
It's Ray Cheska or Keska?
Cheska.
Okay, Cheska. So, your World Ag Forum, tell us a little bit about what the World Ag Forum is.
Well, the World Agricultural Forum was started about 11 years ago, based in St. Louis, for the sole purpose of allowing government leaders, corporate leaders, NGOs operating in the developing world, academia leaders, as well as foundation leaders to come together under one roof to address solutions to critical issues facing agriculture. And it became the first time where developing nations had a real say at the table. It's a neutral forum, mm-hmm. rather than being dictated to by, you know, the larger countries around the world, the OECD countries, for example. This gave them an opportunity to express what their needs are, and so we could address them specifically. And
so
that was the reason for the forum being put together.
Good. Who funds you?
Corporations from different sectors come forward, and they support the organization. They have been there since the beginning and still there today.
Okay, good. Also with us today, we have Raj Patel, who is the Dr. Raj Patel, who is the author of Stuffed and Starved. Raj, welcome to the Food Chain.
It's great to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Good. You're also a visiting scholar at the Center for African Studies at UC Berkeley and a fellow at Food First, right?
That's right, yeah.
Good. Well, tell us quickly a little bit about Stuffed and Starved. What do you mean stuffed and what do you mean starved?
Well, it's a book that explores the contradiction of why we live in a world where, you know, all these food riots are happening, and in a good year, 850 million people are food insecure, and at the same time, a billion people are overweight. So how is it that we can live in a world where there is this hunger and there is obesity at the same time? And that's what the book's about.
Okay, good. So we're both, I guess, the World Agriculture Forum and Stuffed and Starved are kind of looking at the same issue then. Well, gentlemen, it seems like just yesterday the United States was paying its farmers not to grow food, and today the United States is being blamed for the worldwide shortage of food. So what on earth happened? Raj, let's start with you.
I certainly think that the farm bill has put some very unpleasant provisions in it, because farmers are being subsidized, for example, to grow corn not for food, but in order to turn it into ethanol. In other words, you know, we grow food now not in order to eat, but in order to burn it. And that's, you know, every serious expert who's looked at it is saying that this is driving up the prices of food, particularly prices of corn, for the world's poorest people who can only afford to eat corn.
Let's go to Ray and have him follow up on that too.
Sure.
Ray, do you have the same perspective on ethanol?
Well, it's not the sole reason why everything.
Yeah, it's
has
not the sole one, but
certainly, it's certainly one of the factors. I know it's been characterized as being the factor, but it happens to be one that we see all the time, because you go to the gas pump, right, and you fill your tank now for just under $100, and you say, where did it all happen, and how did we get here? And then there's a drive to find alternative fuels, and corn happens to, Raj knows this, it's the largest crop that we have. It was the easiest avenue to travel. And when I first came out of graduate school many, many years ago, I worked for a company that invested with Texaco in the first ethanol plant in the United States. And it sat there quiet for 25 years and not doing anything, but other than making a small quantity of ethanol. Then suddenly, gas prices started escalating, and because it's such a large crop, everybody devoted their attention to that. We had large reserves for it. Unfortunately, those are depleted. But if you look at the rest of the things, it's the changing dietary habits. As incomes go up in certain countries,
let's take the flip side of that energy equation, and let's look at the cost of oil and its impact on the availability of food. Ray, you have any comments about that?
Absolutely. One of the biggest factors to move food around the world is the cost of transportation, is the cost of moving it, whether it's internally within the country or putting it on a ship and sending it out. Both of those factors add a substantial. It makes the markets either competitive or not competitive in many respects. I mean, even today, in the work that we do. We see that the inhibiting factors is that there's a shortage of containers simply because of the big drain that you might have in the big developing countries of the world. China is an example, or India is an example, are a big draw. So those containers head up going that way at a high cost because of the energy cost and come back empty. So there's just something to really look at. And what that means is that food is not going to other areas that could potentially help in this food scarcity that we're talking about.
Okay, Raj?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of things there that I think need to be clarified. First, of course, the price of fuel impacts the way we grow food, not just through the transportation, but also because of the vast amount of inorganic fertilizers that are used in industrial agricultural production today. I mean, the biggest key input in making inorganic fertilizers is natural gas. And so when the price of fossil fuel goes up, then, of course, fertilizers are going to get way more expensive. Fertilizers are hugely energy dense. That's why we have fertilizer bombs, because they require so much energy to pack into them. And, of course, the price of fertilizer is predicted to go up 15-20% in the next few years.
Good business to be in right now, I think.
Well, exactly. But of course,
unless you're buying it.
Well, that's the thing. There are some chemical corporations that are making a ton of cash out of this. But people are going hungry because we are hitched and addicted to a kind of agriculture that demands fossil fuels. And at the end of the day, it's contributing to climate change. The second point is that actually, if you look at every famine that has happened since the Second World War, there was no need to ship food halfway around the world. There's always food available in famine-affected regions. And in fact, this is a big problem with U.S. food aid policy. In fact, that's being changed at the moment. Because the way U.S. food aid works is you ship grain from Kansas to Africa. And you might think that's a great thing to do. But the trouble with that is, if you're a farmer in Africa trying to sell your grain on the open market, and the ship comes in from the United States and you unload the bags of grain saying, gift to the people of the United States, well, then you're out of business. And if you're out of business, then you've destroyed the local production capacity, so that after the food aid goes away, there's no farmers left.
Ray, would you follow up on that one? How does the World Agriculture Forum look at that situation?
Well, I think Raj is right on with his comments, because everything affects everything else. If you go 30,000 feet in the air and you look down the way the food system works and where trade takes place, you have a very different perspective than a farmer sitting, what Raj was just describing. He's impacted by a huge donation. of grain to come into the country. I've seen this happen not only in Africa, we've seen it happen in Indonesia during that grain crisis that happened back in the late 70s, early 80s. It was just horrendous what happened to the local market. But the way the World Ag Forum addresses it is, of course, it's a debate. Ours is a debate from these industry leaders, all people you would recognize and people mm-hmm. names that you would know, that sit there and look at ways. We believe in the following. If we were able to address these issues that we're facing today 10 years ago and had some foresight in moving forward, but we don't. You know, we're more of a shoot from the hip type operation where we have to address the issues that they currently exist.
Well, we like shooting from the hip here too, but we're going to have to take a quick break until we can do some more shooting from the hip. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about the world food crisis, and it is a huge crisis. And we're talking about why it is a crisis, where it is a crisis, and what we can do to survive it. This is the Food Chain. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Ray Cheska from the World Agriculture Forum, Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, and you right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
A perfect storm of troubles out there is leading to big troubles along the world's food chain. How big? Folks, 100 million people, the World Bank estimates, are short of food. There are massive shortages now in 37 developing nations around the world, and big troubles for those who are in dire need of food. So today we pause to ask, why can't the hungry of the world feed themselves? And how did we find ourselves in this situation? With us today, we have Ray Cheska, who is the president of the World Agriculture Forum, and also Raj Patel, who is author of Stuffed and Starved. And I guess some of us are stuffed and some of us are starved. And how did that come to be? Why can't we all be sleek and svelte and strong and well-nourished? It just doesn't work that way. Gentlemen, it seems like there was a perfect storm of troubles. It wasn't one thing. It was a whole bunch of things. Am I wrong? Ray?
You're right. Everything, over time starts collecting, and then eventually you hit a crisis like we have at the moment, where everything seems to be coming together. And I couldn't think of I've been around for a long time in agriculture, and this is the first time in the last few years where I saw so many almost uncontrollable elements coming together. The issue of climate change, you didn't talk about very much 10 years ago. You didn't talk about biofuels very much over the past, but because of, energy costs going up, as Raj was talking about before, is driving the usages of agriculture to solve some of our energy problems. And so what do you use, and where should you go? Corn will not be the key ingredient or the key commodity going forward, but we just need time in order to develop alternatives. So you're looking at agriculture in a totally different way. And now, I talked to a lot of ag writers today, or ag journalists, who say they have a lot more to write about today than they did just 10 or 15 years ago.
Never a shortage of stories for the food chain, I'll tell you that. Raj, let me ask you this. What do you think about the impact of financial speculation on the world's food commodities? Is that having an impact?
Well, it is, and it has to, because the situation we're in at the moment is that there is uncertainty about the future price of food. And whenever there's uncertainty, that there are financial speculators who are able to offer that certainty by buying future options on purchases of crops.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certainly an extent to which financial speculation also has something going on here. And financial speculation sits at the legal end of a range of economic practices that kind of end with collusion. And in fact, in the UK and in Spain and even in South Africa, the government is investigating retail corporations are driving up the price of food as well, way beyond, in the European Union, they found that only 25% of the recent increase in food prices was because of input costs. There's something else going on here. It's not unreasonable to think that financial speculation and certain amounts of market manipulation are going on to be able to drive up profits here.
Okay, so this perfect storm of energy costs, increased demand, we should talk about increased demand too, because that seems to be a significant element being played out here. Many in the developing world now have enough money to buy protein. How does that impact crop prices worldwide, Ray?
You hit it. Off the top of your head which countries are the big drawing attraction, the bigger populations of China and India. Having worked in China and India for many years, you see that shift of moving from bicycles to small cars. Just the obvious things as you walk the streets is just the way people behave, the clothes that they wear. Incomes are going up, and it changes your dietary habits immediately. You move away from the starch or grain-based diet to more animal protein. And if you move to animal protein, guess what? What do they eat? They eat grains. So the demand for feedstock continues to escalate as populations continue to eat more poultry and more beef, more pork. You should see the size of the growth of that area on an international scale, especially in the developing world. So it's a closed system. Agriculture is not unique. It's a business model that is looked at as a business model. It's a model that's not only to feed people, but it's also one to make a living. And it's the living part that really is missing in a lot of the developing. Making a living is missing in the developing nation. They view it as just a way of feeding people, but it's not. If you take a business model and develop supply chains about it at the small scale, from the village level to the regional level to the national level and eventually to the international level, it's all built on a business model. And it's unfortunate that many of the developing nations don't have access to these business models because they don't attract investments in the country.
Which, of course, was how the United States was formed. That was the model that we built the United States on, was the individual landholder with a farm that probably never made much money but was a perfect place for raising people. I often think that my grandfather's farm, his principal crop was people, and it did make a little bit of cash, but that model really has changed. And before we go into what you were talking about, Ray, with respect to making money and earning a living, I'd like to talk about how this food crisis is not just in Africa anymore. It seems to be worldwide. It seems to be in parts of Russia, China, Uzbekistan, all over the world. What's happening there? Raj, can you help us out?
Well, yeah, because what we're seeing in India and China and even in the United States is a sign that hunger is... we're growing more food than ever before. So why is it that people are going hungry? Well, the reason people go hungry everywhere is because of poverty. And there is poverty. In India, for example, although you hear all this talk about the growing middle class, the poorest Indians are getting poorer, just as in the United States. The richest Americans are getting very, very rich, and the poorest Americans are getting poorer here, too. And you see, in other parts of the world, of course, you see the same kinds of increasing inequality. And that means that if you can afford the meat and if you can afford the food, you're doing fine. But many, many, many families, many working Americans, I'm hearing stories about working American mothers, for example, who skip meals just as mothers in Africa do, mm-hmm. so that their kids can eat. And they're no longer able to afford red meat, and they're growing their own fresh fruits and vegetables.
So my hypothetical question at the beginning of this radio show wasn't all that hypothetical.
No, it's absolutely grounded in fact.
Are you talking about essentially the same thing that Ray is talking about, the loss of the business of agriculture?
I think it's important to look at what the difference between how the United States developed its economy and how developing countries are now being told to develop theirs. Because the U.S. and Europe developed huge agriculture and industrial systems behind massive tariff walls with a lot of government support, a lot of government intervention, investment in land-grant universities, the whole thing. But because of organizations like the World Bank, and in fact I was testifying in front of Congress this week saying precisely this, because of organizations like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and a range of sort of development organizations, developing countries are being told to develop their agriculture in a completely different way. Governments are not allowed to subsidize. They're not allowed to support their farmers. They're not allowed to create the kind of infrastructure that then the private sector might come in and support. Instead, they are being told to expose themselves to the winds of competition, which brings us back to the Farm Bill, to your first question. Because farmers in developing countries don't get billions of dollars a year subsidy. And so, obviously, they can't compete with, the European mm-hmm. farmers or the U.S. farmers. I mean, the European Union, the average cow gets $2 a day. And, of course, that's more than most people in Haiti earn. It's a very unlevel playing field. But, of course, in that unlevel playing field, it's obvious that the business model for agriculture is going to look very weird and very odd.
Well, we're going to have to pick that up when we come back from the break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about the world food crisis with Ray Chesko, president of the World Agricultural Forum, and Raj Patel. Dr. Raj, he was the author of Stuffed and Starved. And you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Well, there is a difference between gardening and farming, and sometimes that difference is lost to those of us who garden and think that it would be as romantic to farm. Gardening is an avocation. It's something we do to clear our minds and exercise our bodies and put some veggies on the table and some color into the yard. But farming is a vocation. It's a business. It's what we do to get by in the world, to put a roof over our head, to send our children to college. And so the character of farming is not as quiet and peaceful as the endeavor of gardening. There's a lot difference there. And I guess what we're talking about is why, when we ask the question, why can't the poor, the hungry of the world feed themselves? We're looking at the problem of agriculture as a business. Are we not, Ray Chesko?
Yeah, for sure. And I think the way you position this is the difference between gardening and farming. Gardening, I would view as something for your own consumption. That's mm-hmm. in your backyard if you have it. As soon as you relabel it as farming, suddenly you throw risk factors into the
yeah.
And there you have. Then you're addressing climate change, irrigation systems, mm-hmm. the availability of arable land, and or the productivity of the land you're in. The ability to be able to use genetic seeds to accommodate the conditions that you're growing in, and then at the end of the day, is there a market for what you're growing? And unfortunately, then you get thrown into listening to so many other individuals out there who tell you what to grow, how much to grow, and what the markets might be. And then when you finish growing, and I just came back, I was in East Africa. And they started growing ginger, and because someone told them to start, and it took two seasons, they got the crop, but there was no market for it. They ended up closing down and went back to bananas. Those are the risk factors that you face when you suddenly say, "I'm in the farming, and I'm going to play into this business arena." Part of it, and a big solution to this part, is the educational process, mm-hmm. the creation of entrepreneurs who better understand the vagaries of being in farming. And wanting to use farming as a means of making a living for yourself as well as others, as opposed to someone, if you say gardening, which is pretty characteristic of subsistence level of living down there, And Michael, here's how I view it. There, what's the difference between the person who makes under a dollar a day, and I think Raj hit it right on the head, poverty and hunger go hand in hand. They do. Every place where there's a population earning under a dollar a day, they're also suffering from high levels of hunger as well.
Malnutrition.
So if you solve one, you have to solve the other as well. They both come hand in hand. But the farming part is that what is the difference between the person who spends all his day growing enough in his back garden just to survive himself and for his family with enough food, and the caveman of 300,000 years ago, right? They were hunters and gatherers, and they spent all day doing that. Well, the subsistence level of a gardener, you might call him, faces the same thing without the risks of being in a business. So they're just there for survival, and you'll always have that segment of population. I don't think they ever change. There'll always be some group. We're never able to get everybody out of that. But for those who have had a certain level of experience dealing with entrepreneurship, I think there's an opportunity there to really work with them in a long-term basis to bring them out of poverty and into an arena where they can provide income as well as food, not only for their families, but for the families of the community itself.
Well, let's go to Raj with that notion too. Raj, can we bring a business model into so that the hungry of the world could feed themselves? Would that be a possibility at all?
Of course. I mean, and it's a necessity, I think. I think Ray's right that many of us have just a glancing acquaintance with the tough business that is agriculture and farming, if all we do is sort of potter around and grow our tomatoes. But I think that let's get concrete here. Let's look at a country that has had food riots in which people have died recently fighting over food. Let's look at Haiti. It's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And things have been very dire there indeed. You know, you hear stories of people eating mud cakes in shanty towns in the Cité du Soleil in Haiti.
Now, why?
Well, I mean,
why is Haiti, I guess almost traditionally, in deep trouble?
Well, but it isn't, man. And this is the interesting thing. In the 1980s, Haiti grew most of its own rice, and its rice farmers were brilliant entrepreneurs, and they were able to make a go of it because the government was supporting them to some extent, but they were also able to sell in their own markets, and there weren't the kinds of levels of malnutrition you see today. So what happened? Well, as part of a World Bank and IMF loan, they had to liberalize their rice market, and that meant that Haitian rice farmers, who were brilliant entrepreneurs, but weren't able to compete against U.S. rice farmers who get the equivalent of about $1 billion a year in subsidy. Now, you're earning $2 a day, you're up against someone, an industry that gets $1 billion a year. Of course you're going to get wiped out. And that's why today, no matter how good your business model is, I don't care what kind of business model you got, you can't compete against that. And so today, none of the rice that is eaten in Haiti is grown there. Instead, the bags of rice that you see people fighting over are bags that have the American flag on it saying gift of the people of the United States. Now tell me what kind of business model is going to fix that.
Raj is
right. Michael, can I add a few comments?
Please do.
So if you get to the bottom line of that, somebody someplace made a decision early on that caused this effect. And if you put your finger on what that decision is, many instances there, unfortunately, government plays a huge role in what happens in the developing world. If they're not engaged in the process that you're dealing with, very little happens. And in that case, someone along the way, some official somewhere, made a decision about, no local production, imports only, and look at the end result today, is that because now the high price of rice, specifically, people can't afford it anymore. I think that's true. If you look at the others, Haiti was one, Egypt and China, they all had riots recently, and Mexico as well with the corn. And now even this morning, the New York Times is covering a story in Somalia. There's a young lady who hasn't eaten all week because she wanted to feed her family. It doesn't not able to afford the rice any longer. And so, but somewhere along the line, a decision was made. And it was a policy that needed to change. And can you imagine? Here's a question for us to think about. If you're a head of state if you're a head of state and you have to make a decision relative to food security in your country, you close the borders to all exports of rice that you consume, and that's happening, of course, today, isn't it, Raj? You have, I don't know, a number of countries that that have closed their borders. I think China, India, Vietnam, I think, are examples of that, simply to prevent any rioting that might go on in the country, because they need to do that. But what happens if you say we're going to, you know, only import, and therefore we're going to use this land for other production, and now you run into this case? So the question is, where along this line have we made the decision? Because you know, a small decision today and 10 years from now is a huge impact.
It's a big decision, yes. And it's not just Africa anymore. It's really something that's almost endemic throughout the world. So it would seem like the Farm Bill that the House just passed is not going to solve this problem, but is simply going to exacerbate it, correct?
Right. What do you think? you just testified. I'll let you handle it.
Well, I mean, I certainly think that it will exacerbate the problem. And Ray's exactly right, that somewhere along the line, someone did take a political decision. Now, with Haiti, we know who that is. That's Bill Clinton, because he made it a condition of the restitution of Aristide in Haiti.
Right.
He adopted an IMF loan. So, you know, we know where the buck stops with that one. In a number of these countries, these are very high up kind of political decisions, because they are political. These are around, you know, decisions around the kind of international economy that developing countries must have. And it's not some, you know, nameless official to some extent. It is, you know, the leaders of the most powerful countries on earth.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break when we come back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about the world food crisis with Ray Cheska, president, World Ag Forum, Raj Patel, author, Stuffed and Starved, and you. Give us a ring, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. I am Michael Olson, your host for this bout of What's Eating What. With us today, we have Ray Cheska, who's president of the World Ag Forum, and we have Raj Patel, who's the author of Stuffed and Starved. And we have you, if you'd care to participate today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Let's go to the phones right now and talk with Doug. Doug, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning, Michael.
Pleasure to have you aboard.
Thanks. So I was real interested in hearing your guest's perspective on how food production relates to water. But would it be okay if, you know, because we have a very, very significant food production area here.
Yeah.
And just kind of a few things that are going on with our water here, would that be kind of okay to talk about? Like was one thing, for example?
If you do it in a way that will interest our listeners in Florida.
Oh, well, absolutely. Well, you know, we produce actually 25% of the berries. I don't know, we have berries going back to Florida and the country.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that everybody's interested in all over the country are berries, because everybody loves them. And that happens to be using, in this particular area, Pajaro Valley, not Salinas, because Salinas, of course, in John Steinbeck's novels is well noted as the Salad Bowl of America. But we have a very other significant production area here, the Pajaro Valley, which that's where this berry production occurs. And, you know, Mark Reisner, who passed away, wrote Cadillac Desert, and he had a four-part PBS series when he was here 10 years ago. He said that our loss of groundwater here to saltwater intrusion, 90% of which is used to produce.
And of course, it's just become worse since then. But what is your question there?
My question is, you know, we're losing a huge amount, like 7.5 desal plants. We have to build 7.5 of those every year, like $400 million worth of water to grow $500 million of berries. And you know, the water in the Central Valley and the Sierras and the Colorado River. Something might be interested to people in L.A., for example, is that a $447 million project was just approved to supply the third straw in Lake Mead.
So the question to our guests with respect to...
What do they think about the world water situation and how that relates to food production? And, you know, it takes, like, for example, 1,000 tons of water to grow 1 ton of rice. It takes 16,000 tons of water to grow 1 ton of beef. And maybe they'd be interested. I'd really hear what their comments are.
Good.
Thank you,
thank
Michael.
You for your call, Doug. Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Gentlemen, what about water and this equation of the world food shortage, Ray?
Well, you hit one of the, I would think, one of the key ingredients, I think, that is a depleting resource worldwide. It isn't only this country, but every country in the world is facing it. Even those with large river systems don't have, many respects, sufficient technology to bring it from the rivers into the farming areas. You hit it on the head. And if you deal with Africa, most of the farming is done whatever Mother Nature brings. And they don't have irrigation systems as you would have here. And it's one of the, I don't know if you ever heard an organization called Kickstart. And even at the smallest farm, it's almost like doing a Stairmaster in your gym. That's the kind of mechanism where you step on it yourself and you literally start walking on it, and it pumps water on the small gardens, the small tract of land that you have. It's about as far along as that technology has taken it. And the utility of being able to extract water from waterways, even around eastern Africa, we have Lake Victoria, there is no use of that water in terms of agriculture. And yet it is one of the key ingredients, of course, to increase the yields and productivity. So
Raj,
what does that mean?
Raj, it would sound like some of the stuff people you write about could use some of those Stairmaster water systems.
Well, no. Sadly, I mean, I think that the problem is global. In fact, let me give you a couple of stories. I mean, certainly in Australia, Australia is in the middle of a drought now,
mm-hmm.
and it's one of the reasons why the wheat harvest failed and the price of wheat is so high. And so Australians were a little appalled to find out that, in terms of the water use in the crops that they were exporting, Australia was a net exporter of water in its time of drought because it required so much water to grow these crops. You're seeing the same thing in India, for example, where the epicenter of the green revolution that requires a lot of irrigation and fertilizers and what have you. Well, farmers there now have drained the groundwater dry. You're seeing incredible rates of farmer suicide in India. Because
they've sucked the water out of the ground.
Sucked the water out of the ground, and the improved varieties that they're trying to use aren't working anymore. They need water.
Oh,
the
new hybrid kinds of grains aren't working because they need more water than
exactly.
Oh.
So the problem. I mean, so what we do need to do is start thinking very seriously about the model of agriculture, and the science behind the agriculture that we grow today. And in fact, there was a recent, the International Panel on Climate Change.
Can you hold that? We have to take a quick break, and we'll come right back. Scott,
okay.
We'll pick you up on the phone, too. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Ray Cheska and Raj Patel. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. So few minutes and so much to chew on with Ray Cheska, president of the World Agriculture Forum, and Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved. Raj, you were talking about the model of agriculture and how we have to look at the model and change the model. What exactly are you saying?
There was a report an international panel of experts who said, look, how are we going to feed the 9 billion people that we will have on this planet by 2050? And they came up with the conclusion that actually, the large-scale industrial agriculture that that was dependent on fossil fuels and a lot of water, well, that's not going to get us very far. And what we need to do is shift towards a new kind of science of agriculture that is about building soil fertility without using fossil fuels. And that means smaller scale, local agriculture is going to be the way to go. So
it's really what you're talking about is the kind of agriculture China then lived on for 40 centuries, aren't you?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the kind of agriculture is actually way more scientifically advanced than that.
Yeah.
It's certainly sort of smaller scale, but it's to do with intercropping and growing one thing next to another. And as you say in the trailer for your book, it's about the art of making a living from a very small plot of land. But the way to do that is not by adding fertilizers, but by creating this amazing ecosystem that can support, without input, a great deal of output.
Let's go quickly then to Scott. Scott, welcome to the Food Chain. You've got Ray Cheska and Raj Patel. Go ahead.
Thank you, Michael. You couldn't have better guests to discuss this issue. From what I glean from this conversation, American policies are causing worldwide starvation. And we hear Ray working as an apologist for these policies, which are going over and over and over again, causing problems daily. And then we have here Raj telling the truth. So I'd say to all listeners, listen to Raj and men and women like him, or we will all perish like the world. That's all I had to say.
God okay, bless. we'll give Ray a chance to respond to you. Ray, are you an apologist for that kind of agriculture that is wreaking havoc about the world? Is that what you're doing?
No, I certainly think I apologize for what it is. What I'm saying early on is that decisions that were made years ago impact us today, and mm-hmm. the concentration of where you put your energies years ago affects what we do today. And I don't think that we have a 30,000 view. Just yesterday, in a very lively debate that I had with, is it possible for us to feed everyone as well as having renewable fuels under the same umbrella of agriculture? So you travel to, and this is a heavyweight because it's going to require some really, and Raj is right on, boy, he's right on target, is that we have to change this model, and the model is going to have to incorporate agriculture in a much broader perspective. You have non-food agriculture. You look at Jatropha and cellulosic materials, switchgrass, all of those kinds of things fall under agriculture. And then you have food agriculture, and is it possible for us, if we set policies down in countries around the world where we can do both? And the answer is it's going to require certain technologies, certain kind of farming practices that maybe don't exist today, certain new technologies that's going to come out that will allow us to provide much more yields on a smaller tract of land. It's not too dissimilar to what Europe does over there. Small farms around the villages. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of investments being made today.
And that's probably where we need to go. I want to thank both of you for joining us on the Food Chain today. Ray Cheska, President, World Agriculture Forum. Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved. And I want to thank you out there for joining us as well. Remember to join us next week for more What's Eating What Radio. And hey, cheap food isn't. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.